You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 157 and I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Okay, well, first things first, I want to thank a couple new patrons I had because I forgot to last week because the episode was really long. But thank you to Ishmael and Bonnie Baker. Thank you guys so much for pledging. And thank you to all my new listeners who might have stuck with me after having cognitive dissonance on. So you can support me if you'd like to at patreon.com/atheist. Pretty cool URL, right? Patreon.com/atheist. I like it. But anyway, easy to remember. Hit that up if you'd like to support the show. So to my new listeners, if indeed any of you stuck around after listening to Tom and Cecil last week, this week is going to be a bit of a change up. I've got a Christian on for this week who I'm going to go to shortly here, and it was a really fascinating interview. It was a Christian who truly wants dialogue and truly wants Christians to be more accepting. So very interesting person to talk to. Now, I will warn that for whatever reason, the Google Hangouts connection was not very good. We battled it. I edited a lot to make sure it was acceptable listening quality, but it still was a little tough just because of internet problems. I have no idea. We couldn't figure it out. But I think this is an important discussion, and I'm not going to let a little bit of fuzz stop us from hearing it. So apologies for that, but I did my best. But all that aside, here's my interview with Nathaniel. Joining me right now, oh, I forgot to ask, how do you like your name pronounced?
I like Nathaniel.
Nathaniel. Oh, okay. Is it spelled differently or am I just, you know, somewhat less intelligent than the average person?
Some versions of my name is spelled with an IE.
Got it.
And mine's just, yeah.
Nathaniel. Okay. Well, that's easy. I think I was just psyching myself out. I was thinking too hard about it. we're definitely fighting the Hangouts audio connection right now. It's a little iffy. We're going to see how it goes. I was given your name and a recommendation from my friend Tracy Moody. How did you guys meet?
I actually don't know her in real life.
Okay.
She stumbled across my photo of Jesus and I at Chicago Pride this year. And, then she liked it, and we started talking, and I think she thought I was an atheist to begin with, but I put out there that I'm a follower of Christ, and then she's like, would you be interested in being on this podcast? So I'm like, sure, I don't mind talking.
Well, that pretty much catches us up. There you go. yeah, no, that's cool. Yeah, that campaign looks really interesting. We can get into that in a second. First, why not a few background questions, if you don't mind? Were you always the current religion you are? Were you born, you know, were you raised in this religion? Did you convert? I'm just curious about that kind of stuff.
Well, for starters, I will say that where I'm at in faith, if I'm to be labeled, and in the words of Kierkegaard, when you label me, you negate me. Mm. But I do recognize labels do have their place, so don't get me wrong. But I would identify as a red-letter Christ-centric universalist.
Well, that's a lot of labels for which I don't totally have a complete definition in my mind. But so maybe we'll have to go through it anyway.
So I would say where I'm at in my faith journey is very far from what I grew up in. I did grow up in a evangelical household, evangelical Christian household, and it was very conservative in nature.
Okay. Well, perhaps let's reference the campaign that you were part of to give people some perspective on that. So why don't you – it did involve you dressed as Jesus holding a sign.
No, that's my friend.
Oh, that's your friend. Oh, okay. I thought – oh, I got you.
Jesus.
What's that?
I'm the one next to Jesus.
Ah, okay, okay. Well, at any rate, either way, it involves someone dressed as Jesus. Is it your friend Jesus? No, I'm just kidding. You're like, that's my friend. It's actual Jesus. No, it involves someone dressed as Jesus, sort of counter-protesting people who are holding up very hateful signs about gay marriage. Is that an accurate quick summary of it?
It is.
Cool. So how'd you get involved with that?
Well, I have been involved with what is known as the I'm Sorry campaign out of Chicago for Chicago Pride. I've been doing so since 2010. And for the last 2 years, so last year's Pride Parade and this year's Pride Parade, my friends and I have actually decided to be at the end of the parade where the protesters are, and we've gone there to act as a buffer for those in the parade and around the parade, but also to counter protest the protesters.
Right. Yeah. And it's pretty funny. It's a good idea. Also, obviously I would think it's a very kind thing to do. I think a lot of people would look at it that way, to kind of help battle against hatred and that sort of thing. But you mentioned you were perhaps raised more conservatively. So I'm curious, when did that kind of turn around for you? I mean, would you have always been someone who would have counter-protested these people? Or maybe might you have been one of those protesters at some time? Maybe not that far, but would you have been more sympathetic to that cause at some time earlier in your life?
Earlier in my life, I was sympathetic to the protesters. A lot of what I knew about the LGBTQ community came from a bunch of straight people, and it wasn't always favorable. And
yeah, they're not experts.
And I guess like what was the shifting point in my life was in 2010 when I was driving to school. My commute was about half an hour away from where I lived, and so occasionally I would take time to just pray. And one day on my way to school, God opened up to me just different circles of people that I hang out with, whether they're Christian circles or circles of, you know, I'm involved in youth groups, so youth ministry circles. And then God's like, well, do you love the LGBTQ community? And I had to be honest with God and myself, and I had told him, no, I didn't love the LGBTQ community. Because love requires proximity. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of gay friends in my life, but God laid it upon my heart. And I honestly want to say I audibly heard God say, I'm sending you to the Chicago Gay Pride Parade.
Wow.
Yeah. And initially I was going to go there with some friends and have a mock confession booth of sorts there. Not so much for people to confess to us, but for us to say we're sorry for the way that.
So, but was it just like that? I mean, it seems like that was a quick turnaround there. Was it just that you heard God essentially speak to you, saying something that God's not normally reported as saying, right. go to the Gay Pride Festival. I don't think he told any of the Israelites that, but But yeah, and so it was just that him speaking to you in your mind, or, you know, oh, sorry, I don't mean to belittle that, but your experience of him speaking to you, and that sent you all the way like 180 degrees to where you wanted to not only go experience gay pride, or at least, you know, witness it maybe, but you were already turned around to where you wanted to support it?
I would say it was a progress. Definitely that was a good step in the right direction, a big step in the direction of my life. It did start with being involved with the Marin Foundation's I'm Sorry campaign in Chicago that year in 2010. But it has come back to like a local level of me being involved with the local chapter of PFLAG that I'm involved with. So
if you don't mind my asking?
Parents, friends, and family of lesbians and gays. I go there as an ally. I go there to build a bridge that has been destroyed, unfortunately, so much of the time by the Christian community. And so I'm doing what I can to act on a local level, but also take it to Chicago. with the I'm Sorry campaign. I've actually taken it out to Los Angeles last year, and I was fortunate to hear that it continued on this year, where there are other followers of Christ who share that same message of saying we're sorry for the way we've marginalized and treated the LGBTQ community.
Huh. Well, I apologies for repeating myself. I'm just very curious about your process of, because we can talk more about it, and you've certainly already talked about how what you've done to support the LGBT community, and I definitely commend you for that. And that's really cool. I was just sort of curious because I know I was actually raised fairly conservatively, and I remember in college when it very early on in college when it kind of turned around for me, when I went from someone who would have been like not a supporter of gay marriage to someone who thinks, duh, you know, no duh. Yeah. And it was just merely for me was just meeting and interacting with, you know, LGBT people for a very, very brief time. Like that's all it took. I'm just sort of curious more for about your transition. If there's any, was there any, because I know for you, for me, I'm an atheist. It's pretty simple. It's like, for me, the only reason I was conservative about that was just the environment I was in. There wasn't any good like argument for it. For you, I'm wondering if the transition was a little different because maybe were there, you know, religious arguments you had to reevaluate? Was there text in the Bible that you had to reevaluate? Anything like that? I'm just curious.
There was a lot of reevaluation. In my life, some of it just came down to reading the Bible again and looking at it through the lens of Jesus. And did Jesus say anything about the LGBTQ community to condemn them or, you know, withhold love from them? I don't find that to be true. Some people will be like, well, there are other parts of the Bible, but I'm like, if we're to be honest with how we look at the Bible, it should be through the lens of Jesus and no one else. But yeah. Like that transformation was, I would say it was pretty much like overnight, John.
Oh, wow. And, wow. Well, that's really cool. I mean, I'm glad to hear that. And it certainly, certainly speaks to maybe the potential for other people to change. Is there anyone in your life or family or whatever who you have to deal with who's still maybe anti-gay, anti-gay rights and all that kind of stuff? And how does that go for you?
Yes, there are family members who do not see this perspective as I do. And I do what I can to tread the waters carefully to essentially give them room to talk. But I also give myself room, and hopefully, most of the time they do give me space to talk as well. But I do recognize that sometimes it gets heated among my family members, and so I just peacefully back out of it because it's not really going anywhere productive, and it's just becoming a lot of cliche phrases and a lot of misunderstanding and just ignorance.
Hmm. Do you see it as an inevitable change in Christianity as a whole, or at least not, obviously not 100%, but do you see being more accepting to LGBT as the way that Christianity will ultimately turn?
I truly believe that is the case. You're absolutely right. Not everyone will shift to this mindset and to this an affirmation of their LGBTQ community brothers and sisters, but yeah, I do believe the church is headed in that direction.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, effectively, that will make people a lot nicer. That'll have an overall effect of making people more kind and accepting, I'd say. Now, from reading your blog post and reading a little bit about you, it looks like you were covered by Huffington Post to a certain extent last year when the Chicago Pride happened?
Or right.
Was that? Yeah, okay. And from what you said, it does strike me that you are very devout. And I would say that while I've definitely had Christians on the show, I would say that you may be like the most overtly religious person I've had on the show. So I first want to say thank you for agreeing to talk to me and thank you for coming on an atheist podcast. But I also wanted to ask, along similar themes as acceptance of gay people, Is it a similar theme that makes you more inclined to interact with people like me or you know, just non-believers, other religions, that sort of thing?
Well, for me, I think what happens in any relationship is that the shift that comes with getting to know someone. And I would say in my life, relationships have been everything, and relationships have shifted me for the better. I was just recalling to myself of how involved with a diversity group when I was in college. And one of the things that came out of that diversity group was having a friend who's a Muslim. And it's gone the direction of we're still really good friends. So she's out of the area now, but, you know, we still keep in touch. And even like this past year, June 17th, to July 17th was the month of Ramadan for Muslims. And there actually was a movement earlier this year where Muslims, in solidarity to their Christian brothers and sisters, did Muslims for Lent. I personally, in response to that, participated in Christians for Ramadan, where I partook in the 30-day fast as well.
Wow. Well, but how do you, if you don't mind, and I very much with the spirit of I just want to commend you again for being open and for being charitable to other religions and for being accepting of other people. All that, I want to just emphasize that I think that's all a very positive thing. But I do sort of wonder about the logic of it when it comes to, you know, what both of these books say and how it's diametrically opposed at times. How do you reconcile that? I mean, I think most Muslims would say that their religion is the only valid one and Christianity is not valid. I mean, do you encounter that? What do you think about that?
I experience that some of the time. I was at the mosque not too long ago, and I was just talking to different people about how their fast was going and just what does it mean to be a Muslim in their lives. And a good amount of people gave me the response of, like, it's better to be a good human than a good Muslim. And it seems you will have people who are diametrically opposed and kind of like, well, the Quran says this, well, the Bible says that. And, you know, that ultimately is, you know, debate, not dialogue. You do have, you do have those people who are going to come to the table and just, like, you know, bring their strongest point of view to combat the other person's strongest point of view. And it's a case of what I do in my own life is try to provide space to have dialogue that, you know, these are what I think, this is what I think, and someone can present, this is what I think, and just, like, working for that common ground of, like, all right, what do we have in common? Like, what are our goals, our aspirations, our dreams for our community and for the community at large? And, you know, working within that frame of, you know, I guess you could call it, like, interfaith dialogue.
Do you think there are limits to that, though? Because, while completely acknowledging, I think that's a great thing. And I think that understanding and cooperation with each other pretty much, I think it's a good antidote to kind of just hatred and ignorance and all that. And I think it certainly calms down, I don't know, fundamentalism, I think, to a certain extent. But are there limits to that? When one book says, you know, Jesus is not the Messiah, and another book says he is, or something, for example, does that, you know, what's the solution to that? I mean, it fundamentally, does it ever come down to just, well, we can't agree on this? And, you know, some people get pretty angry when you tell them, you know, Jesus is not the Son of God, or vice versa, that Muhammad is not the final prophet of God. You know, what do you think about that?
You raise a good point, and honestly, I don't know.
Okay, well, hey, I respect that.
I haven't gotten to that point yet with dialogue where we've come across a patch of rough water that we could resolve, or just, like, you know, peaceably live in the tension, even if that does seem oxymoronic.
Well, I really appreciate that honest answer, and I think that another part of it, maybe you certainly, I mean, I've only known you for a few minutes here in a podcast sense, but you come across as a very kind person, and I think that sort of kindness definitely goes a long way to diffusing disagreements like that. But I guess maybe what can happen is when communities get insular, you know, when they get just sort of cut off from diverse points of view, I think it's maybe that's when, you know, maybe that's when the fervor comes a little higher and the out-group, in-group, out-group dynamics come into effect more. And you're right that when you approach people kind of openly and you talk to them, no matter what the religion is, the point of view, usually you can find common ground with them and it kind of calms people down. You know what I mean?
I do. Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's see. It was a good, honest answer, but unfortunately it sort of deflated any questions I had on that line of inquiry. Do you, can you share any experiences you've had that, so you're saying you've never had an experience where you just were unable to continue in a conversation like that or?
Right.
Okay. Well, what are some of the more, do you have any, experiences that come to mind that have been interesting examples of this interfaith dialogue or this inner not faith dialogue, I guess?
I was talking to a guy not too long ago. He's a Muslim guy. And one of the things, you know, we talked for like 2 hours and it seemed like 20 minutes.
Wow.
And out of that conversation, I just got a strong sense of just, you know, how much he wants a better place for, you know, his family. He has several young kids, and they were clamoring over him sometimes and, you know, politely interrupted us, and sometimes it wasn't polite. But there's that notion of, like, even in my own being, I recognize that, you know, I don't want a better world just for my tribe. I want a better world for everybody.
Yeah.
And certainly one thing that comes to mind is, like, I don't know what my legacy is going to be, but I work on what I can on a local level, and maybe that will just have like a ripple out effect of influencing and interacting with people around me might make the world a better place, you know, on a larger scale. So,
yeah. Well, what are your views of hell then? I mean, because that doesn't sound like a better place for anyone.
Yeah, I agree. I personally believe that the only hell that exists is the ones that we create for ourselves and others. So the notion of a afterlife, eternal damnation, you're being tortured forever, knowingly or unknowingly, consciously or unconsciously, I don't believe in that kind of a hell.
Hmm. Do you, how does that reconcile with scripture? I mean,
I would say, like, you know, what hell are you referring to? Because if you dive into, like, the New Testament and get into the Greek being used and even, like, to a certain extent, the Hebrew being used, you have a lot of, you know, metaphorical language that people in that day and age could identify with. That, you know, one hell, I want to say it's Gehenna, was actually, like, the garbage dump that was burning day and night, you know, methane being burned off even in that day and age, as you know, that was understood. Oh yeah, you're talking about this, you know, place outside of town, but it's not an actual literal hell. And for some people it might be like, well, you know, but there has to be this place where, you know, people are, you know, tortured. But I'm like, for people to say that there needs to be a hell, I usually question them why. I question them why, because, you know, they will say in one breath that God is love. But how can you say God is love if he's torturing a portion of humanity?
Yeah, that would be what I would say.
So for me, it doesn't, in my mind, when I try to rationalize it out, it doesn't seem congruent that there is this, that you can say God is love, but then say there's a hell and people are being tortured there. So
what do you think about the fact that this is such a new way of looking at the Bible? I mean, how do you account for the fact that for 2000 years, rough give or take, you know, this isn't how people looked at it? I mean, people believed in hell. People believed in this stuff. Does that ever bother you? Are you ever questioning, like, why would God do that? Why would God give his message in a way that only now, when people are finally starting to be okay with gay people, like, secularly, then Christians are going to catch up with that. You know what I mean?
I do. But I would say that, like, my views on hell or the lack thereof isn't, like, new. There were older church fathers where, you know, if you want to think on, like, a broader scale of things, just like universalism, universalism of, you know, everyone being reconnected and to themselves, God. So the notion of just kind of like there is no hell, but in some shape or form, we will all be reconnected. That's a very old theology as well.
But popularly, you would have to say that, I guess, but most people were misinterpreting the Bible for most of the time, right?
Yeah. Definitely evangelicalism, there seems to be that notion that hell exists. And honestly, I don't know all the reasons, but at times I think it's just like crowd control, that instead of winning people over by faith and by love, it's winning people over by belief and fear. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you'll have the masses keep on coming back every Sunday. This is what you need to do in order to get to heaven. And for me, it's just, there's so many paradigms going on. It's the up, down, left, right, black, white, heaven, hell. And I want to believe, well, I do believe that the gospel message is not exclusive, but it's inclusive. It's not just a select few, but it's everyone. And for me, I would rather operate out of love than fear. And that keeps me going, even though sometimes it's almost like I do question God. I do ask God, why this, why that? But for me, it just keeps on coming back to God loves me and God loves everyone.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the topic of these sort of theological disagreements and all that, how do you deal with quotes? The ones that I always see when this topic comes up are Jesus saying that, you know, what is it? That essentially every word of the old law will remain true, that sort of thing, like where he sort of endorses the Old Testament. What do you make of those quotes?
Jesus came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it. And there are several times where it's recorded where Jesus said that, like, you know, you have heard it say, but I say. And it's like, you know, he's not dismissing what's said, but he's coming, or he's communicating, you know, a new way of thinking. That's why you have, like, verses that say, you know, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. And that was, you know, revolutionary in his day and age. And I think instead of allowing that kind of anger and that hatred to continue on, you take it out of the equation by forgiving that person. And granted, you know, it's easier said than done. I have a hard time forgiving people myself, but I do believe that's like the healthiest way to go about it, that instead of perpetuating a cycle that's damaging to someone else or their family or even their community, how broad you want to make it, that by working to forgive that individual will make things right and set things back into motion as they were meant to be.
Well, I think that's a great message. I would feel like I was perhaps being hypocritical if I didn't at least offer what I think is a difficulty with your point of view. And I want to again emphasize that I like your message and I like what you're saying, and I don't take this hopefully is it that I'm trying to battle against that very good impulse you have and the example of Jesus that you have in your mind. But the only thing that worries me about your point of view is it seems like you, and this seems to be a very common movement now, and it's probably for the better, that people are taking what they know Jesus to be. They know Jesus to be love and acceptance and a lot of good qualities. And then they're turning that around on the Bible. And then interpreting the entire Bible using that image of Jesus as sort of a truth, you know, a divining rod. Is that a fair-ish assessment of it?
It is. I do use Jesus as the basis to how I read and interpret scripture. Yes.
I mean, the first thing that people would point out is that it's a bit circular because the concept, you know, the concept of Jesus and the character of Jesus does come from the Bible to begin with.
Right.
I think, I guess I would imagine that Christians would probably argue, maybe you might argue that you have some sort of concept of Jesus in your heart or something that comes from a more fundamental place than the Bible. I don't know. Is that what you would say?
If I am to examine myself carefully, probably.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think the only trouble I have with that is, for one, you can't really argue with it. I mean, I can't – there's nothing that I could say to – first, you – I mean, not that you necessarily want to, because I think it's good if you have something in your heart that is a very kind and good impulse and you're trying to live by that example. That is a good thing. But the only problem I have with it is if someone says that same thing but it's a bad impulse, I can't – there's no argument for it. I mean, if someone has in their heart – written on their heart a concept of Jesus that's not as accepting, you can't, there's nothing you can argue or say, you know, there's no argument you can make to convince it, because it sort of comes from something that's inaccessible to me. You know, like, I can't access your kind of idea of Jesus and where it comes from and all that. That's the only difficulty I see with it. And I hope you've taken that in the spirit I intend it with. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I understand what you're saying, and yeah, I agree. But at times, you know, I just haven't really had, while I do meet conflicts, it's, you know, primarily with people who are dwelling on, you know, the writers of the Old Testament, their perceptions of God. And a lot of them do like to use, like, Old Testament verses or even, you know, even like New Testament verses that Paul said, and Paul was misaligned in several ways. So just, he was very misogynistic. He was very, you know, women have to cover up their hair when they're in church. And so a lot of people use an old lens on Jesus instead of like a new lens. And I'm not saying like Old Testament means outdated, New Testament means the, you know, only guideline someone should go by, but there just seems to be a lot of mindsets that dwell on who people thought God was, which was found in the Old Testament, instead of focusing on, you know, what's attributed to what he said and did in the New Testament. And so my arguments with them is kind of like, well, how does that fall into play with, you know, who it is and, you know, what's attributed to what he said and did? And, you know, for a lot of people, they can't really do much with, like, well, their stance, except to kind of, like, rehash what they, you know, picked up in the Old Testament, but without putting Jesus over, using Jesus as a filter, what's being said.
Do you think that the Old Testament is the Word of God? I mean, I'm sure you don't know this because we just met and we just came across each other, but I have another podcast where I'm reading through the entire Bible as an atheist. And okay. I actually just finished the Old Testament. It took me 5 years. I'm not joking about that. 5 years to do it in podcast form. But do you – there is so much wrong with the Old Testament, as I think you would agree. I mean, there's so – to me, nothing has been more obviously written by humans and not by God, to me. I mean, it was really hard to get through. It's not a good book. The Genesis and stuff in the beginning I can see is as interesting and all that, but there is just so much nonsense toward the end of the last, like, at least half of the Old Testament is just really hard to get through. And I wonder, I have often wondered, like, if Christians had just taken the New Testament and just said, this is our Bible and forget everything else, I would find it as so much more of an attractive worldview. I wonder if you can comment on that. I mean, value does the Old Testament have still?
Yeah, it would be more attractive if we just had the New Testament instead of the Old Testament. But with the Old Testament, at times, so much of it I read figuratively instead of literally, but I also recognize that I don't see, like, God wrote the Bible. It was people in real places, real times, writing about their experiences and, you know, writing about their interaction with God. But I do see a lot of man's handiwork in the Bible when portions of the Bible saying, hey, God just told us to go to this village and destroy it and then kill man, woman, and child. And for me, I just really question that and even doubt that, hey, God told you to just kill everyone. You're using God as your scapegoat. The God told me to do so on a large, grandiose scale. I see that as man using God as a cop-out, as a, you know, some kind of rationalization for what they're about to do and what they did do, killing people, supposedly with God's, God backing them up in their actions. So,
well, God told you to go to Chicago Pride, so... So, but I suppose that was a much more positive message.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that's interesting. I appreciate the honest answer. And it sounds like, to try to just fairly represent your view and let me know, it sounds like you'd say that parts of the Old Testament are very just human written and they weren't actually inspired by God. But then you think there are parts that were actually inspired by God. Is that a fair assessment of your view?
It is a fair assessment, but, you know, as you said, you read the, you know, you did a podcast on the Old Testament over 5 years, and I'm sure you can attest that, like, so much of the Old Testament covers, like, the entire scope of humanity.
Yeah.
Ups and downs. You know, you read Song of Solomon, so, hey, sex is in the Bible. Surprise. But, you know, just, like, it covers... to a large extent, the human experience. And while it was man-written, you know, it definitely covers so much of humanity already. So even though I dwell on what Jesus said and did, as that, you know, hey, you know, this speaks to me on level of the Old Testament because, you know, they went through it too, whatever that is, you know. But it definitely... Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead and finish your thought.
No.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, and this may seem like a random question, but while we're on the topic of the Old Testament,
yeah,
do you, maybe you have some insight. Why did God choose the Israelites as his chosen people? I don't understand it. There seems to be nothing special about them. The entire book is about them being horrible people and doing everything wrong and never listening to God. And yet they're still his chosen people for some reason. Why didn't God choose Native Americans or maybe some sort of, you know, someone in Asia? Why is it this is the holiest of people and the most important, you know, group of people? Do you have any view on that?
I don't. Why them specifically? I don't know.
Does that ever come to mind? Does that ever bother you or no?
It does because, yeah, absolutely. It's a very... moody group of people. They're leaving Egypt and they're complaining about, like, the lack of food, and then they start, like, reminiscing about the good old times in Egypt. But at the same time, they were leaving a place where they were slaves to a country. They were, you know, in bondage. So, you know, that's a very quirky, perverse kind of nostalgia where not what was better, what lay behind you, but at the same time, your conditions were horrific, so I have no idea, man.
They do have a talent for complaining. I'll give them that. I think that the Israelites were very, very good at finding anything to complain about. What is there anything in the Old Testament that comes to mind as something you think is very God-inspired and important in your life?
I would say that, throughout the Old Testament, just that up and down and the redemptive nature of God in that sense of the Israelites are following close to God. And then they, like, get bored or, like, you know, Moses goes to a mountaintop for a while and he's out of sight, out of mind. And so they want Aaron to make them a, you know, a golden calf. So it's just like, you know, he's only been gone for, like, what, 30, 40 days? And
I just made fun of that very thing because I find it so ridiculous.
Yeah. It's like, he's been out of sight for such a short period of time, and they're already like, all right, so God's gone, apparently, because Moses is gone. So something about them is just like, if I were God, which thankfully I'm not, I would have a really hard time just like, really, I want to take you back in again. I want to, you know, leave my light on for you to like come back home when you feel like it. But just there is that arc of like the up and down with the Israelites and just across the Old Testament of God always taking them back. And I just love that nature of, you know, redemption and grace and just, you know, that none of us are beyond redemption or grace. I love that.
Well, I appreciate that answer. Well, I mean, I feel like I could go on with you forever, but it's been a while here. I don't know. Is there anything else, any message to my listeners? Is there anything else you'd like to say?
To your listeners, I would say that I'm sorry for the way that Christians have screwed up. I'm sorry for the way, you know, since this is an atheist podcast, I would say for lack of understanding, and that perhaps just like writing it off of like, because you don't believe God exists, that, you know, you're not worthy of our time. And, you know, I don't have a lot of atheists or agnostics in my life, but I do know that, you know, I want you in my life. I want to talk with you. I want to dialogue with you and be in community with you because, you know, there's so much good you bring to the table, and I want to hear you out. So I will find in your hearts time to hear me out and what I think and why I believe too.
Well, I really appreciate that. I think that's a good message. I know that, I mean, it's not all kumbaya at times because, you know, there are genuine disagreements that, both groups have with each other, but I do really appreciate you coming on here. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. You're a very nice person and I think you're a good Christian. I'll say for what that's worth. This atheist thinks you're a good Christian.
Well, thank you for saying that, Thomas, and thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you very much. All right, so here's the thing. That was a bit of a false start. No, a false end. A false ending because actually, Nathaniel, we got off the recording. I turned it off. And then Nathaniel started asking me some thoughtful questions. And I said, hold on a sec. Let's record again because, you know, why not get this included as part of the dialogue we had? So for episode 2 this week, the conversation is flipped a little bit. Nathaniel asks me some questions and I answer them. And then we had some further discussion and it was really enlightening. I liked it. So it was pretty cool for Nathaniel to do that. And so that'll be the next episode, and then maybe I can have time for a little bit of analysis or something, but we'll see how that goes. Okay, so without any more nonsense here at the end, thank you for listening. I really appreciate all my listeners, and I most especially appreciate my patrons who signed up at patreon.com/atheist. And that's it. I will see you on Thursday for more with Nathaniel and some other things going on too. So tune in then. Thank you very much.